time. Hear more of that as the afternoon and the days progress. Stay tuned for The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille.
This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM in your dial, bringing you ideas, guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. Today we're talking about loneliness, a very interesting subject. A recent article in New York Magazine pointed up some of the dynamics of loneliness. One of the most interesting stuff is, do you know that New York City has as many in apartments? How many apartments in Manhattan would you have guessed have just one occupant? One out of eight? One out of four? What do you think? One out of every three? The number is one out of every two of all 3,141 countries in the United States. New York County is the unrivaled leader in single individual households at 50.6%. One out of two people live alone. More than three quarters of the people in them are below the age of 65. 57% are female. Now, that's kind of amazing. It's quite an amazing thing for a city, because for a strange reason, I mean, if you look at it a little further, you would think that loneliness correlates with depression and with suicide, naturally. But there's a funny thing. The correlation with suicide is the bigger, the more populated the city, the lower the suicide rate. So all of this becomes kind of fascinating. We wish we could just open the brain up and study it and say, what goes on the inside over there? What makes people be alone and okay while other people are alone and not okay? What is it that's leading people to want to bond with other people? Are there any dynamic facts? Are there any physical, biological imperatives demanding people get together with each other? Is being alone such a crime? Can you really make it being alone in this world? Well, thank heavens, neuroscience comes along, and with it, John T. Cacioppo, who with William Patrick wrote a book called Loneliness, Human Nature and the Need for Social Connection. John is with us as our guest here on WBAI. John, are you there?
Yes.
Oh, how nice. Perfect. Well, John, there is so much that you have to say about this. That I want to start off with the basic need. Do you think humans need to connect? Do you think that it's part of our biology? Part of the? Do you think it's a mandate? Do you think it's like that? You can't be a lonely wolf. You got to be connected to other people. What do you think from what you found?
We've looked at that question. We've looked at the heritability as well as the need to connect, and it seems quite clear that primates, humans in particular, have this need to connect with other individuals. There are individual differences. Some people have that need greater than others. But going back to Harry Harlow, we know that if you isolate a human or if you isolate a monkey, it does grave damage over time to that individual.
So if you isolate them, it does. But isolation is different than being lonely. You could be somebody who just chooses to be alone and separate and not isolated.
That's absolutely right. Most species, when they're alone, it does damage to them. All species except for humans, if they're isolated, if they're ostracized from a group, they perish. Humans are much more abstract reasoning creatures, and it's not the actual isolation as much as it's the perceived isolation that's damaging the humans. So exactly as you're suggesting, people can have blissful solitude as an existence, or they can be isolated in a crowd.
Yeah, there are a lot of people I know who have been married so as not to be lonely, but have been more lonely, more suicidal, and more depressed.
Yes.
Now, I put those three together, being that that's my line of business. Loneliness, depression, they seem to go hand in hand.
They do. Now, there's more than one way to become depressed, as you well know. So not all lonely individuals lead to depression, and not all depression is caused by loneliness. But we've looked at that question, what is the association between the two over time? And we find that loneliness does contribute to the likelihood an individual will fall into a depressive state.
Well, what does that mean? What does that suggest? Let's look inside the brain. Now, you've had a chance to do some brain mapping. What did the neurobiology teach us?
One of the things that we find from our brain imaging studies of loneliness is that when people interact with others, for the most part, they're likely to have positive interactions rather than negative interactions. That's just statistically, if you look across your day, your interactions with others tends to be positive rather than negative. When we looked at an individual in the magnet looking at pictures, we can't actually have them interacting because of the nature of the measurements, but when they're looking at pictures of positive interactions, the lonely brain doesn't show the same strength reward response as the non-lonely brain. So that they actually show less ventral striatal activation when looking at a positive picture involving other people compared to a positive picture that has no people in the picture.
Wait, make that suggestion again. Therefore,
they are actually showing less a reward response to positive pictures depicting social interactions.
So it means you're more depressed?
It means that you certainly don't get the same reward from walking around and seeing other people in happy circumstances or interacting. We did.
It's like going numb. It's like an anhedonia.
That's right. That's right. There's less a strong. Now, interestingly, the lonely individuals aren't anhedonic about all stimuli. So when we showed them pictures of chocolate cakes or delicious meals, they showed a strong response of this reward area of the brain. It was the social pictures that they showed the weaker response to.
Hmm. Armand DeMille here with it. So John, this must be really exciting for you. I mean, the research that you've done. Let's take it a little further. Let's talk about the lonely heart as you see it.
Yes. One of the effects that we've seen is lonely individuals show greater resistance to blood flow throughout the body. It's called vascular resistance. And other research, the Framingham Heart Study, for instance, had documented that vascular resistance predicts subsequent elevations in blood pressure, the development of essential hypertension. We, too, now have found that loneliness is associated with increased blood pressure over time if that loneliness is maintained over years.
How would you account for that?
It's the vascular resistance is a type of threat response that people show. If you put somebody under conditions of threat, they show this increased resistance. And what they're doing is they're shunting the blood from the skin, from cutaneous vascular beds, into muscles, into the organs.
They may be a threat.
They may be a threat. They may have to engage in a fight. And so this is an old evolutionary response that has adaptive value. But when it's maintained over years as a function of being lonely or feeling isolated, that's when there's grave damage that occurs to the cardiovascular system.
So loneliness is a condition in which a person on some level craves being connected to other people, and therefore they maintain attention because it's not like being a turtle, you know. If you're a turtle and you say, all right, well, I'm safe. I could be a turtle. You don't have to be tense to be a turtle.
Right.
Because you have a certain amount of safety you can go through. Because you're an animal who's still wanting. Now, there are people I've heard of and people I've seen who want no connection with other humans. They just want to be alone.
Right.
We don't call that loneliness.
Right.
Loneliness is a feeling of wanting or wishing you could connect with others.
Right.
Is that true?
Not being happy with the connections that you do have, or feeling that you have no real deep connections with other individuals. So it has to do with the quality of the relationships you have, not the number of the relationships.
There are certain times of year when people are particularly lonely. Is that true?
Yes, that is.
Tell me about that.
So one of the interesting cross-cultural findings that has emerged is that people in collectivist cultures are actually lonelier than those in independent cultures. So America is relatively independent. We think about the autonomous individual, and we cherish that. Other countries, China, Italy, are much more collective. The way to think about it is when food is served at dinner, you know, we get our food in a bag or a box, or it's placed in front of us on a placemat where it's just our food that we're to eat. In China, it's placed on a big cylinder that gets circled around the table where people can pick up from that lazy Susan the food that they want to eat. But as you turn it, you have to be sensitive to everybody else at the table. It's kind of a collective eating circumstance. The reason for it, people might think that collective cultures are associated with lower levels of loneliness. It's quite the opposite, because when you find yourself lonely in that culture and you look around, it's especially isolating to feel like I'm the only one in that condition. We see the same thing around holidays. So the recent holidays that we went through, our Thanksgiving is a holiday. The norm is for friends and family to get together and to have some celebration of familyhood and friendship. If you happen to not be in that circumstance and you look around, because the norm is for everyone else to be like that, it's a particularly isolating existential loneliness during that period of time of year.
And it's for you to face it at that point. I mean, I've seen people from China who let the plate pass them because they're already depressed.
Right.
And what happens is you're now allowing, you're sinking into this depression, which means I am separate from people.
Right.
I am different than everyone else.
No one
loves me. No one wants to love me. One of the great theorists once said that depression is the belief that you can never get anyone to love you. And if you were to translate that into your book, it would mean it's the belief that you can't get yourself, or one of the forms of depression is the belief that you can't get yourself connected to other people.
That's exactly correct. And in fact, I think that's one of the implications of our research is that part of the issue of depression is this disconnection with others and the low self-esteem that derives from that disconnection. And one needs to recognize that antecedent, that cause, and deal with the social cause of the depression.
So how do some people get stuck in chronic loneliness?
That's a very good question. Loneliness is a threatening state. Again, if we think about it ontogenetically, we all are born to abject dependency. We depend on caregivers to put us in a position where we might fend for our own. But that's a matter of years, not moments. We're not like fruit flies or sea turtles that are born and are ready to go at birth. So we depend on others. And to not have those others around us to take care of us is threatening. If we look at evolutionary time, we see the same story, that under conditions of privation, we need others to fend off wild beasts and to share and find food together. And so the absence of that is a very threatening condition. In fact, what we've argued is that loneliness is an aversive signal. It's a very unpleasant state, very much like hunger, thirst, and pain, to signal a fundamental need for our survival. To survive and prosper, we require other individuals, at least across our evolutionary time.
If you were to study the brainwave patterns of people who are feeling physical versus loneliness or emotional pain, how big a difference would you find in the hippocampus or
in the amygdala? You see
the amygdala.
Same. Yeah, the amygdala is active. You see the rostral part of the anterior cingulate active, same areas that are involved in pain. If you go through social rejection, you see the same kind of brain activation as if you were in physical pain.
If you have the same kind of brain activation, do you therefore have a compensating kind of hormonal reaction, or do you have a chemical reaction to deal with it? In other words, if you feel physical pain, it's going to set off some endorphins and a bunch of other chemicals to deal with it. Are you saying because it's similar when you feel loneliness, there's a kind of a numbness that comes over you, and it may be explained by the fact that you're going through a reaction that's akin to a physical pain?
There can be, but what we see more often is the same stress reaction that you would, hormonally, that you would see if you were preparing for a major fight. So we see larger morning rises in cortisol, a very powerful stress hormone that metabolizes energy and prepares you for fights. Now, indeed, cortisol, if left unchecked, can also do grave damage to your biological system. And that's exactly what we see over time in these lonely individuals. But what happens is because we don't think about loneliness from from an evolutionary perspective. Instead, we in our society think about it as a personal weakness. We tend to deny feeling lonely or ignore it and think that I can be my own island. I'm supposed to be an island unto myself. And so it's just something I'll have to get over. And that's a little bit like ignoring hunger cues. If our society felt hunger was a stigma, we'd have a lot more anorexics walking around. So some of the chronic loneliness comes from people simply wanting to deny it or think that they can sustain themselves without the presence or involvement of others. And we are fundamentally social animals. That's not the case.
Well, there's a problem here because, you know, a lot of the people who I would say are psychologically evolved, and by that I mean people who decided not to get caught in the matrix of the fantasy of what today's stresses are, fighting about who's got the bigger car or fighting about who's got the right clothing or how many children you have. A lot of people have kind of stepped out of it. And the ones who have stepped out have said, I'm not going to be in a miserable marriage just to be in a marriage. I'm not going to have children just to make my mother happy. I'm going to be stepping aside and I'm going to step out of this culture and I'm going to step out of this need to have a relationship. Therefore, I'll be alone. And I think one of the things that you're saying is, yes, doing that may be very good for you. But you also have to be aware that doing that is going to have certain physiological consequences as well as emotional consequences that you may be perfectly okay with if you're willing to accept it, but not to deny it.
Right. And I'm also saying it's the quality of the relationship. So we know that from Linda Waite's work, marital status, being married, is health protective on average. However, we worked with Linda in a study here in Chicago and found that marriage was associated with better health, but as soon as we took into consideration whether they were lonely or not, the marriage benefit went away. What that means is it's not being married per se. It's that on average, if you're married, you're less lonely than if you're not. But it's feeling connected to people, not the marriage per se, that's important. So those individuals who are not married but have a connection with other individuals, doesn't mean they live with them. Doesn't mean they spend a lot of time with them. It means that they feel somehow secure and connected to others. They're just as healthy, in fact, healthier than the married person who's miserable and unhappy and feels isolated.
My guest is John T. Cacioppo. The name of the book is Loneliness. Fascinating stuff. You know, John, earlier today I was talking to a client who was talking to me about having had this perfectly good relationship with this wonderful wife that he has, and they've had a wonderful time, and now she is clearly perimenopausal. And during this phase, he talks about how completely at odds he feels with her because she's attacking him for every turn, for every discomfort she feels, and she no longer feels romantically attached to him, and she feels hot flashes all the time. And she can't sleep with him because of the smells of his body and all this stuff that goes very often along with menopause and perimenopausal states. So I imagine, and having consulted with him and many other men, that the menopausal time is a very challenging time for men because I don't think the menopausal women go through the sense of loneliness. They feel isolated and angry. But I think the men who have had this romantic connection with someone for so long are suddenly found at fault and they're rejected completely, yet they want to stay in that marriage. They deal with a tremendous sense of loneliness.
Right. Well, I would think both the man and the woman in that relationship could experience a sense of loneliness in the sense that the woman is also going through a number of changes which are really quite threatening to her way of being that she's established across her lifetime. But I agree, we may recognize that more quickly than we recognize the secondary effects on our partners, and that is, you know, the husband and the circumstance you're talking about. Both are important to accept and understand.
Tell me something about where we all come from. Where does this sense of connecting to are the apes and the gorillas all the same? Do we inherit this all the same way? Is there a significant difference?
Yeah, there's a significant difference. Many species are ready to go at birth. I alluded to the sea turtles. They reproduce by having so many turtles on the beach that some are likely to survive long enough to reproduce again. Humans and a handful of other species have a slightly different reproductive argument. Because of the long periods of abject dependency, we need, it's not our ability to reproduce that determines what makes it into the gene pool. It's the ability of our offspring to reproduce. And we are, we don't have the same defenses of armor that the turtle has that you mentioned, or of flight, or of the claws of a bear. Instead, it's our ability to work together and communicate that gives us an adaptive advantage. But in each of those cases, you see where it's very important that we connect to others and that we're able to work and communicate and cooperate appropriately. That's where the evolutionary benefit of working as a group comes from in humans.
Talk about the bonobos. You've done some research with them.
We have. Sometimes, you know, I chuckled in reading Freud around, you know, it's at the turn of the 20th century. Freud was popular, as you all know, and it was all about sex and aggression. And over the 20th century of research, we found out that Freudian theory had real flaws, and it was more about evolutionary psychology. And so we talked about chimps and bonobos. And, of course, what characterizes chimps and bonobos, respectively, is aggression and sex. So I'm not sure we actually moved that far in 100 years from where Freud suggested versus where evolutionary analyses of our primate cousins moved us. What we argue in the book is indeed both of those are important adaptations, but humans are neither chimps nor bonobos. That what we have that's somewhat unique is a third adaptation, and that is we not only socialize, but we use our big brains to figure out what can we do that's good for us and for others. And that's this sometimes talked about as a win-win philosophy. It's what we saw not happening on Wall Street in recent weeks, and what we've kind of heard as a call for going back to being concerned not only for one's self-interest, but, you know, for us to do well as individuals, we have to be in communities and societies that are also doing well. Being very wealthy in a society where money no longer means anything isn't very useful.
You know, I want to go back to the bonobos for a moment, because it's the interpretation. Sex is a very fascinating thing related to loneliness. If you think about sex for the sake of sex, if you think about it as going to be a way of exchanging some kind of bodily fluids, leading with orgasm and good feelings and connectiveness, that's one which may or may not relate to loneliness, because you could wind up just as lonely after sex as not having sex at all. But if you look at sex itself as saying, well, it's not just about the physical release, but it's an attempt to make a connection. It's an attempt to engender this oxytocin, even if it's randomly selected. You're trying to get a sense of connection. And wouldn't sexual addiction sometimes be a person's extreme loneliness manifesting in a compulsive behavior?
Yes, in fact, I'm glad you raised the issue of oxytocin. That's a very powerful hormone that's associated with its release during sex. It's released as a function of orgasm. It's an emotion. It's a hormone that's associated with feeling bonded to an individual. We know from studies where oxytocin has been administered intranasally, which allows it to get to the brain, that social trust goes up in such individuals. You trust those associated with oxytocin release. So these are basic chemicals that permit human bonding and attachment. And if you feel like an absence for that, the oxytocin can be kind of a substitute for that feeling. So you keep doing inappropriate behaviors, perhaps, in order to get that oxytocin boost.
Yeah, I know a lot of people, a lot of relationships, couples who are married, who hold each other for that oxytocin, but they don't need the sex anymore.
Right, right.
That happens.
Yes, it does. And exactly as you suggested, massage and holding are both causes to promote the oxytocin release in humans.
Do you think that if you have that kind of connection, and do you think with the oxytocin, people tend, who are not lonely, to become less ill than people who are lonely?
Yes, I do.
Now, is that only because somebody could tell you you're looking sick? You know what I mean? If you have somebody around and you're not alone, they tell you, you know, you're not looking so well.
Yes.
But is it more than that? Is it that there's actual physical falling apart when you're alone?
Yes, and a hint to that, you know, in 1988 there was an epidemiologic study published showing that isolation was associated with broad-based illnesses and earlier death. And the explanation for that was exactly the one you were suggesting. It is that when you have others around, they tell you, oh, you're looking sick, go to the doctor, or I'll make the appointment for you so you can go to the doctor. And the absence of such people means you get less health care. But you know, I alluded earlier to the fact that other species, if they're isolated, other social species, rats, mice, dogs, even fruit flies, die earlier if they're isolated. All of these are social animals, and that suggests it's something more than a spouse that's telling you to, you know, take care of yourself or making the medical appointment. And indeed, in our own research, we have found a whole host of factors, physiological factors, a cascade of events that make one ill and lead to an early death because of being isolated, feeling isolated from others.
Well, think about that as a part of nature. Nature designs us, or designed us, so that we would live a certain number of years while we still have our reproductive years. And then as soon as we lose our reproductive years, they start kind of finding less use for us, and we get more illnesses. And, you know, you're supposed to walk out on the ice by the time you're 45 years old and just kind of turn it over. But now we're living much longer. So now we take people who are naturally isolated by their age,
right,
by being older. You know, nobody touches you anymore.
Right.
You don't feel the connection anymore. And we put them in homes. And in these homes, did anyone ever study what the life expectancy is of someone who is in a home as opposed to someone who is not in a home?
That's a complicated issue. We do know that loneliness increases the likelihood you will move into such a home. That if you're isolated outside, that you will seek any kind of comfort, including non-independent living, at an earlier point. That was done by Dan Russell and colleagues in Iowa in a study of Iowa residents. So we do know that. We also know that loneliness doesn't go up in old age until late in life. So the 65-year-old is no lonelier on average than a 25-year-old. It's kind of a surprising finding. But what happens is, as they get older, they start to lose friends and family, and that's very painful. They may reconnect once, maybe twice, but then as they look out, they see friends like these new individuals who they might form a friendship. They stop doing that because it's so painful to lose them, and that's when loneliness skyrockets. Now, one of the things we could rethink is how do we relate to older individuals? They have a lot to offer younger generations, and if we were to have older individuals helping to take care of and inform the young, I mean, there are very few little brothers and sisters to help those individuals in need of, you know, in need of mentoring. If we were to do that, then there would be a better intergenerational transfer of wisdom and support.
I think it's got to be two ways, too. I think one of the things that happen is as you get older, some part of your brain gets you to tell stories that are very boring. You know, and what happens is you turn away people because what you're saying is gets to a point where the story is just so long. You so welcome the attention of having anybody's attention that you just tell these long, long stories. And I mean, the training has to go both ways. You got to train the young people to learn from the older people. And you got to train the older people to connect to the young people, too, and care about whether they really hear you or not, or whether they really understand you or not. I think it's got to go both ways.
I agree.
It's only one way.
And, you know, we've had a tendency to think about education as being something for the young, not the elderly, because the elderly don't have the same link that they can pay dividends from that investment. But research has shown if you educate older adults, in fact, they're less likely to develop dementia, or they stave off the time in a non-demented state, and they're much more productive and happy. So there are real reasons to think about such investments being, you know, having payoffs in terms of health costs and what they can contribute to younger generations.
I think so, too. So you're saying that there is an Alzheimer's loneliness connection?
There is, in fact. David Bennett and Rob Wilson at Rush University in Chicago did a study of Alzheimer patients and found loneliness predicted the progression of Alzheimer's disease, an absolutely stunning finding. And it was not due to the development of plaques and tangles, the typical factor involved in the progression of Alzheimer's disease. They were not able to identify the specific mechanism, but it was a very strong effect.
A very strong effect that people who report loneliness seem to have the Alzheimer comes in faster?
Yes.
That would make sense,
Alzheimer's,
you know. I mean, it does save you.
Right.
It does save you. Your mind is, you're feeling lonely, and your mind comes and protects you.
Well, if you're lonely, you don't have the same people you cherish and you're happy to go talk to. So part of it may be that as lonely individuals don't engage in the same social interactions, don't engage in the same intensity of social interactions, don't derive the same pleasure from it, then they're at greater risk for progression of dementia.
My guest is John T. Cacioppo. C-A-C-I-O-P-P-O. The name of the book is Loneliness. We're going to take a short break. I'm going to play you some very special music for you, John, as well. And then we'll continue with our discussion.
TalkBack is your gathering place for the free and fair exchange of information and ideas heard here Monday through Thursday from 3 until 5 in the afternoon. I'm Hugh Hamilton. Join me as we explore the issues and events making news across the nation and around the world with expert guests, insightful analysis, and, of course, your comments, questions, and observations. That's TalkBack right here on WBAI New York.
Hi, this is Lloyd Price, and you're tuned to WBAI New York. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio.
Okay.
Oh, no, Lordy, 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 Miss Claudia. God, you sure look good to me. Well, please don't excite me, baby. No, it can't be me.
All right.
Go.
Find love, you and I. It's a new game to play. Then we tell our first lie and see love go away. And we find we're alone. We rush on, you and I. We don't need love at all. We need thrills, we need speed. Then we stumble and fall. And we find we're alone. We're loyal, you and I, to flowers that are dead. We forget how to cry. We save photos instead. And we find we're alone. We hear guns, you and I. We ask, what is that? Times we're informed where it's at. And we find we're alone. We're moral, you and I. We stand for what's right. We slaughter. And I, we're alive and secure, but in a bank and the church we can never feel sure. And we find we're alone. We've made it, you and I. We have glory and fame, yet we never know why. We feel so ashamed. And we find we're alone. We have power, you and I. But what good is that now? We would build a new world if we only knew how. And we find we're alone. We are old, you and I. We beg warmth from the sun. In the dreams that we dream, we ask, what have we done? And we find we're alone.
Pretty dramatic. That's from Jacques Brel. Sean Elliott, Alone. Have you ever heard that, John?
No, I haven't, but it's nice.
It's quite dramatic. It's from Jacques Brel, Is Alive and Well. There's a, let me ask you something. We're speaking with John Cacioppo, who's from his book Loneliness, L-O-N-E-L-I-N-E-S-S. John, let's talk about cookies. I thought that was kind of fascinating. You know, why lonely people tend to get fat.
This is a wonderful work by Roy Baumeister at Florida State. What he did was to look at what's the effect of having found yourself rejected or facing a future without friends, what did that do to your ability to have executive functioning, to exert self-control, for instance, to perform particularly complex cognitive activities? And what he did this by experimentally assigning people to one of three different conditions. And one of the conditions, they were given false personality feedback and told, although they had friends now, that would change and they would live a life of isolation. And those individuals, versus a group who were not told such bad news, were allowed to test cookies, eat as many as they wanted. These were fattening, unhealthy cookies. To rate them on food quality. And he found that those who had been given the bad news of a future of loneliness exerted poor self-control. They ate a lot of cookies.
So if they were given a bad news about maybe nowadays I don't care about how I look if I'm going to be alone.
Right.
So I'll eat as many cookies as I want. Or is really eating a lot of cookies and having those unnecessary calories in your body, is it a way of storing yourself up, you know, for hibernation when there's going to be a drought out there, when there's not going to be anything available?
Those are great questions. And I might mention there was a control group, another group was given bad news, but not bad social news. And it wasn't that undermined the self-control. Now, it could be, as you suggested, they just didn't care what they would look like if they were going to be alone. But that's not likely to be the case. We did research where we looked at lonely and non-lonely individuals, and we had them do what's called a dichotic listening task. The details aren't important, but what's important is the individuals in this task have to exert self-control to find the sounds that we were piping over tapes and they were trying to find as part of the task. Lonely individuals were less able to exert the self-control needed to do the task than non-lonely, and it had nothing to do with, for instance, what they might subsequently look like. It seems that loneliness is such a miserable state, people take shortcuts to anything that would make them feel good, including eating delicious foods.
You know, and also, when you think about delicious foods, or you think about cigarettes, coffee, all the other addictions,
yeah.
A person does form a relationship. Like, I know tobacco is a relationship. That when you're smoking, you have a relationship with cigarettes. I mean, you know, who else can make you feel so good in such a short period of time? Pick it up when you want to pick it up. Put it down when you want to put it down. You know, go out, take it out with you, and nobody notices it. You're in the middle of a boring date. You pull out your cigarette, you put it in your mouth, and you smoke it. It's like you have a constant, constant source of nurturance.
Uh-huh.
Same thing with food. Food is a source of nurturance. You form people relationships with your addictions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why many addicts are so often perceived as being loners. Because they have a relationship. I have a relationship with cocaine. I have a relationship with heroin. I have a relationship with food. I have a relationship, and it's a relationship that won't turn me down. It won't hurt me. I can get it as long as I could find it. I could stay with it, you know? It's a predictable as opposed to a potentially disappointing love.
That's very interesting. Now, you know, one of the things that we have found is that lonely individuals are more likely to anthropomorphize. That is, they're more likely to impute humanity into non-human objects, pets, gadgets. We did a study in which we took various little gadgets and asked people questions about the humanity, the free will of these various gadgets, and we manipulated whether the people felt lonely or not. And those who had been made to feel lonely imputed more humanity to these gadgets, to little robotic agents.
I wonder if people give names to their computers.
Yes.
Well,
yes,
what effect? Let's talk about loneliness and the computers.
Yes.
What has computers done to people who have been so absolutely alone, isolated, stayed in their houses, never gone out, and now they have a computer and they could visit at random?
So it's done two things. For some who were isolated, for instance, perhaps because of a health condition, having that computer, being able to interact with people that they otherwise would not have been able to interact with, has been a boon. It's been a real lifesaver. It's allowed people to connect where otherwise they were not able to connect. But the surprising finding is that that turns out to be more of an exception than the rule. Many individuals who have gone to the computer away from face-to-face interactions, have sacrificed the face-to-face so that they can nurture 4,000 friends on Facebook, for instance,
mm-hmm.
Those individuals have become lonelier and more depressed as a function of technology, not less. So it really depends, how is it being used? Is it being used as a way to connect, to improve the quality of one's connections, to have more face-to-face interactions, or is it being used to replace those face-to-face interactions?
It's kind of interesting because, you know, one would imagine that a parent's new role is to now limit, like they used to limit TV time.
Yeah.
It's like, it's almost, if you want your child to interact with the world, you limit computer time too.
Right.
You know, you say, all right, you got 2 hours on the computer and then get out of this house and go play ball or do something. I wonder if parents feel the urge to do that.
I don't know if they do, but it's certainly good advice. I mean, to use the computer to find out where your friends are going to be and to connect or to develop that team so that you can go out and play ball is a great use of technology. To use it as a replacement and where you then are just an isolate with your computer avatar, that's been shown to not be as healthy for individuals.
Well, it's kind of an interesting thing because if you do that, I mean, I can't imagine why a group of teenagers who are isolated would separate, would want to get together physically when they could do practically everything in communication on the phone, on the computer, including have cameras looking at each other. You know, I mean, isn't it taking us to the point where we're saying you may not be lonely, but you no longer have to be physically present with another person?
You know, not exactly. There's so much that goes on non-verbally when present with individuals that we're unaware of, but that contribute mightily. You've heard and perhaps participated in meetings that were via video conferences links. So you can see people. Or worse yet, are the phone teleconferences where you can't even see people. Those are very difficult to actually feel like you have a rapport with the others sitting around the virtual table. When you're in the presence of others, there's so much information being transmitted that we're unaware of. We have all kinds of contagion processes. We'll start to mimic one another in that setting. You can see this when people are walking down the streets. They look like they're walking individuals, you know, completely separate, and then they meet, they walk off together, and immediately, spontaneously, without effort, they become synchronized, and they look like a single unit walking away. These are things that we're geared to do automatically, but it's very difficult through thin-stranded telecommunication devices.
You know, it's kind of interesting. I have friends who, when they want to file a complaint, I know people, I've been thinking about one friend recently who wanted to file a complaint with a bank because a large amount of money going from Italy to her home wasn't transferred. And so she said she talked to the bank over and over again and they can't seem to get it. And after about 12 contacts that wound up very angry, I said to her, have you ever been to the bank to talk to anybody? And she said, no.
Right.
And I said, you see, on telephone, which is what I realized, there are now people who are trained to handle complaints on phone, and they're used to anything you say. You could scream all you want. Because you're not in their presence, they no longer feel that threatening force. They don't feel the impact of your presence. And I think people are forgetting that to get things done, you're so much better off face-to-face with anyone.
Right.
You know, that what happens on a telephone is cute and nice, but it's not a contact.
When we think about those, we think about the information that's in our short-term memory, you know, that's in working memory. And that's probably the same when you're standing in front of someone versus you're on the telephone with someone. But as you well know, there's so many different pieces of information that are being transmitted that we're not as aware of. And that's what you can't get across. And you know, those subtle signals include signals that establish rapport and establish empathy. So you can imagine the bank agent who's going to be much more empathic and feel a sense of similarity and rapport if you're sitting in front of the person versus just a voice on the other end.
That's right. They have to deal with you. They can't just be insulting and they can't, I mean, they will deal with you. You're a human.
That's right.
John D. Cacioppo. John T. Cacioppo. John, you talk about your experience in Grand Central Station. I thought it was so touching. I thought I would make a mention of that for our program today.
Sure. I was in New York for a meeting recently and had a little extra time. And so, like many tourists, I went to Grand Central just to people watch. You know, I do it for profession. So it's fun to go and just watch individuals as they move through Grand Central Station. And one of the things I'm always struck by is exactly the synchrony that we were talking about a moment ago. People walking around, they look like little ants, but they pair up or they form these groups all of a sudden. You don't know who it's going to be that actually meets, but then they walk away and it looks like you have this single superorganism that's walking away together. And experimental studies have been done where they take individuals in such groups And that individual either synchronizes or not with those others in the group, and they find that the rapport, the liking, the willingness to work with that person in the future is a function of whether synchrony was established or not.
Wow.
So it's a very powerful, subtle influence that we really don't even think about.
You know, and the being able to, you talk about trying to help people determine whether they're alone or not, and I know the book is of value because you list all the things. But let's talk about the survey you do about how people feel and why.
Yes.
And what are the things that you go over? I mean, do you want me to read them to you, or do you want to?
Sure, go ahead and read them to you, and then we can talk about
them. So here's a question. How do you feel you are in tune with the people around you? How a person would rate that, how they would score that, right? How often do you feel you are in tune with people around you?
Notice in those questions, the one we never ask is, do you feel lonely? Which seems odd, since that's what we're measuring.
Yes.
We never ask that question.
You do ask, how often do you feel alone?
Yes.
What's the difference?
Lonely is a trait that's been stigmatized. So people don't want to admit that they feel lonely. That's a weakness. Now, they can feel alone, but that's not labeling themselves as a lonely individual. We have too many extreme cases where, you know, we have school shootings and the person's labeled as being a loner. And so there's a real stigma, a danger about labeling yourself in that fashion. So all of these questions have to do with beliefs that we know to differentiate lonely and non-lonely individuals, feelings and experiences that help us separate where you are on that dimension without asking a person to self-label.
So you have an always, rarely, or never here, high and loneliness?
Right.
So a person who is lonely, how would they answer the following questions? How often do you feel that you lack companionship?
They're going to say frequently.
Frequently.
Yes.
How often do you feel that there is no one you can turn to?
They're going to say frequently on most of these items. Not on all, but on most of the items.
How often do you feel alone?
Right. Again, about two-thirds, and it'll be different items, but about two-thirds of those items they're going to say frequently, too.
How often do you feel part of a group of friends?
Mm-hmm. Again.
Again, frequently. How often do you feel that you have a lot in common with the people around you?
Right.
That's a difficult one because you're not even around people.
Right.
How often do you feel that you're no longer close to anyone? You know, loneliness, do you think if a person were to examine their loneliness and try to in some way examine whether they feel isolated from their own families?
Mm-hmm.
If you have a sense of connection with your family, brothers, sisters, mother, father, and you feel really connected with your family, do you think you could still be feeling alone when you're on your own?
Yes. So in fact, we have looked at that. If you are located distantly from your family and you have very strong ties to your family, then you can feel a real sense of isolation. College students, this is common. College freshmen are notorious about coming in and feeling lonely because they've left family and friends behind, often for the first time in their lives. And although they're around more people in college and living in dorms than perhaps they were in their hometown, because of that distance from family and friends, they feel very isolated.
One of the things that makes a person feel lonely is when they have relationships that are not meaningful, a relationship that's just a surface relationship with your neighbor and stuff like that. It's in your questions. And is shyness a part of that? Do you think lonely people feel shy?
They do. But the interesting thing, so shy people are more likely to be lonely. Introverts slightly more likely, but it's not a strong effect. What we find that's more surprising is that when we experimentally manipulate loneliness, so we make one group feel lonely and another group not, the group we've made to feel lonely feels shyer. They feel like they have poor social skills. So that's interesting in the sense that when you're talking about adults, it's not the shyness and poor social skills that's producing the loneliness on average in most of us. It's the feeling of loneliness that makes us feel awkward socially, not know exactly how to act in a social setting, and to feel shy as a result.
So you've kind of linked loneliness with illness, loneliness with kind of sadness, maybe with a shorter lifespan.
Right.
Loneliness and suicide, is there a correlation that's direct?
Yes, there is. One of the strong antecedents, causes of suicide is feeling lonely, feeling distant from others, feeling dismissed by others. When you no longer feel there are people around you for whom to live, then you're at risk for suicide.
at risk for suicide because there's no reason to be around. There's nobody to be connected to.
Exactly right.
And do you think that, therefore, somewhere along this life, people are going to invent some new kind of drug? Like you were saying, you know, there's a nasal spray called oxytocin.
Right.
I didn't know that could be delivered nasally. Yeah. It can?
Yeah. Huh. It's a big molecule. So if you, you know, if you take an injection, it doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier. But if you take it intranasally, then it will cross the blood-brain barrier.
Does it, it's used with autism, I believe?
I don't know the research on autism. The research on normals is still relatively new, and that's the work that I'm familiar with.
So do you think that there's going to be some chemical developed to help people with their feeling of loneliness?
I'm actually concerned about that, and here's why. If you think about heroin, heroin kills not only physical pain, but social pain. It dulls that. And so you might think, well, we have a drug and it's heroin, but as you well know, loneliness is a signal that prompts us to connect in meaningful ways. If we eradicated that need to connect, it would be like eradicating physical pain. And people who have no physical pain signals aren't the happiest people. In fact, they have trouble surviving. These are people who have a very difficult time remaining alive. So if we eradicated feelings of loneliness and got rid of this very important signal for our species, I worry that we might actually undermine some of the glue that gives us our humanity.
So it could be put in your water supply if you want to control the people and keep the people going, or, you know, pump it in your air supply
right. And
make you really feel connected. You know, I'm surprised the casinos haven't thought of that so far.
Right. Exactly.
Right? Oh, the only place I feel at home is in the casino.
Right. That would be very powerful. Exactly.
Although, you know, a very interesting thing about gambling is gambling casinos are usually a place for lonely people. And there is a false sense of connection that you get through the gambling experience. You see it in the horse track, at the racing tracks, you see it in the casinos as well. That during depressive times, people do not stop gambling, they do quite the opposite. They gamble even more. And one wonders what that's really for. It's probably because they need to gather somehow. They need to be able to get together to be with other people.
It's interesting. It may well be a lot of it. That just just anything reinforcing, and a win in that setting gives them a shot of reinforcement, a reward that they can't find elsewhere.
Name of the book, Loneliness, L-O-N-E-L-I-N-E-S-S, by John Cacioppo and William Patrick. So, John, I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
It's very exciting. We may have to do this again at some point. Thanks
Anytime.
For taking your time.
Anytime. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Hey, I thought I'd take a couple of minutes to play you one last piece of music related to this. Of course, if you want a copy of today's program, you can go to thepositivemind.com. You might want to send it to somebody, you know, who's lonely. Or you can go to WBAI.org. And on my way out today, let's see. Here's a little something by Sophie Millman. Just kind of an interesting piece for our show today.
Skyline seems to disappear when you're lonely in New York. Sidewalks don't lead anywhere when you're lonely in New York. Rush hour traffic, not a soul around. The echo of your heartbeat makes the only sound. Broadway is a dead end street when you're lonely in New York. Rockefeller Center doesn't rock when you're lonely in New York. Central Park, just a parking lot when you're lonely in New York. The lady with the torch is your one and only. City that never sleeps, your nightmare never ends. You trade Manhattan for a string of beads when you're lonely in New York. sleeps. Your nightmare never ends. You trade monotony for a string of beads. When you're lonely in New York, I say you trade monotony for a string of beads. When you're lonely in New
5 FM on the magazine Talkback with